can have a seat. I do hope that that is true of us today, that we do find ourselves more and more aware of what God is doing inside of us. And I think that has been the point of this series we've been in over this last month. Today is our last day, talking about Not in My Backyard. And our whole point was to become more aware of what God is doing inside of us and around us, that God's presence doesn't just live inside of me, it lives around me, in my neighborhood, in my community, in my family, in my workplace. And how do we view the world around us through the eyes of Jesus? And so as we've been doing that, I came to today and realized that there are really two kinds of people in the world. One kind of person is the person who goes the extra mile. They are the person who goes above and beyond to complete the task or to cross the finish line, to do the work and to see something move forward, right? And then there are the not my job kind of people. These are people who would say, I don't know, that's not my job, right? Who would say, I did what I was told, and even if it didn't make sense, somebody else has got to worry about the thing that I just did, right? These are the kind of people who say, it's just easier to say, somebody else can worry about this, right? I don't know if you've, maybe you've run into a not my job kind of person. Maybe you work with them. People who don't quite get it right and they don't really care, right? Have you ever been the not my job person, right? When you're putting up the Christmas decorations this weekend, maybe, and you're like, I don't know, I don't really care, somebody else can figure this out, right? Maybe you've been the not my job person. I have one of my best friends often finds himself in the not my job category all the time, and he always has this phrase on his lips after giving a real half-hearted effort. He says, well, it's good enough for the girls I date. And then he walks away. So I don't know what that means. He's still single. I guess that says a lot. I don't know. But in this series, we've been asking a lot about questions about our neighborhoods and about our communities and the people around us. Lots of questions about the people around us and how to see them, how to see them through the eyes of Jesus. And in week one, we really talked about this dichotomy of what does it mean to ask questions that protect who I am and my way of life and my resources and my stuff versus what does it mean to be good news to the people around me? And so we asked this question about good news and what does that look like? In week two, we faced this tension that I think we all deal with, that it's natural for us to place barriers between ourselves and other people. And we realized and we learned that when we place barriers between ourselves and others, that we end up placing barriers between ourselves and God. And there's a lot of a work that we need to do to take action to remove barriers between ourselves and other people. And then last week we talked about another tension that we face, in that we tend to think of ourselves as isolated individuals, but the fact of the matter is that our everyday choices impact the people around us. They impact our neighbors, and that God has placed people directly in our path, directly in relationship with us on purpose, for a reason. And we have the opportunity to ask, what's good news for me, or what's good news for them? And that's been the challenge. And so today, I'd like to end this series about asking questions about what's my job? But what do I do with this conversation? What do I personally do? What do we as a community do with this conversation? The writer of Proverbs tells us in Proverbs 14, all hard work brings a profit, but mere talk leads only to poverty. Right? Which means that it certainly is challenging to have this discussion together, to have this conversation, to talk about it for 3 weeks in a row. But if all we do is talk about it, then we've really missed the point, that we've missed the point completely. If all we do is walk out of here and say, well, that's not my job, that's somebody else's job. I'm sure the preacher on the stage, it's his job to figure out what happens with this and what do we do with this. Then we've really missed the point, because if you're relying on me, you're in trouble. But if you want to follow along with the Bible, we're going to be in two stories today, Genesis 19 and Luke 15. Our message today takes us into this conversation about responsibility. That's where we're going today, and it comes in two parts. Our message today has two parts. The first part is about the responsibility of a community, and the second part is about the responsibility of an individual, right? And today we have an Old Testament story, and then we have a New Testament story in Luke that Jesus tells that really helps us wrestle and struggle and move towards responsibility and towards action about this conversation we've been having. So if you have a Bible, we'll be in Genesis 19 to start, and we'll have it up on the screen too if you want to follow along. And this is how the story starts. Genesis 19, verse 1. The two angels arrived at Sodom in the evening. Lot was sitting near the gate of the city, and when Lot saw the angels, he got up to greet them. He bowed down with his face to the ground. "My lords," he said, "please come into my house. You can wash your feet and spend the night there. Then you can go on your way early in the morning." "No," they answered, "we'll spend the night in the town square." But Lot wouldn't give up. So they went with him and entered his house. He prepared a meal for them. He baked bread without using yeast, and they ate. So here's how our story begins, with angels, right? God has sent angels to be strangers to Lot and his family in this community that he's a part of in this town called Sodom. But it begins with outsiders. It begins with two people, two angels, two outsiders. And it shows a man named Lot who lived in the town and who welcomed them. Right? He's sitting at the city gates. He says, "You got to sleep at my house. I'm going to make you Thanksgiving dinner." Right? And we have the beginning of like a Hallmark quality movie here of these strangers being brought in. But it doesn't stay that way, right? So then in verse 4, before Lot and his guests had gone to bed, all the men came from every part of the city of Sodom, young and old men alike surrounded the house. So now we have a point of tension. And so before long, this party takes a real dark turn. And the insiders of the city, the people who live in this city and call this place home, they call this place theirs, come pounding on the door, and they're ready to assault these strangers that had entered into this house. And Lot stands up for them. He even offers his own family just so you don't do anything to these guests, right? And then in verse 8, Lot says, "But don't do anything to these men. I have brought them inside so that they can be safe." So that's Lot's response to what's happening in this conflict and this tension. But then the response of the men of the city say this in verse 9, "Get out of our way," the men of Sodom replied to Lot. "You came here as an outsider. Now you want to act like a judge. We'll treat you worse than them." They kept trying to force Lot to open the door. Then they moved forward to break it down. But the angels inside reached out and pulled Lot back into the house and shut the door, right? You can almost see this sort of movie taking place. In the nick of time, they reach them out and he pulls them in the door and they slam the door shut, right? And at this point of the story, things get really hectic, really hairy, but the angels grab Lot, they grab their family, and they say, "It is time to go. We can't stay here. This is a problem." And then they give Lot this reason why it's about to get worse before it gets better. In verse 13, "Many have cried out to the Lord against the people of this city. So he has sent us here to destroy it." So now we get this reason why angels are walking in the door, right? "Many have cried out." People have talked to God about what happens in this city. And we came to see it for ourselves, and he wants us, and God has sent us to destroy it. So Lot, it is time to go, all right? No messing around anymore. So the angels and Lot's family, they all head for the hills. And by the time they get out of town and the sun rises, in verse 24, this is what they see. "Then the Lord sent down burning sulfur. It came down like rain on Sodom and Gomorrah. It came from the Lord. It came out of the sky. The Lord destroyed these cities and the whole valley. All of the people who were living in these cities were wiped out. So were the plants in the land." And scene, right? That's how the story ends. This is a dramatic story, right? It's filled with all kinds of visual here. It's filled with all kinds of conflict, not just between people, but between God and a city. There's conflict everywhere because God himself saw something was rotten in this place, in this city, right? Something was so bad that God literally rained fire from the sky and said, "Not even the plants are gonna survive." And the story does not even explicitly tell us in the story that we read. It doesn't say, it just says, this place is so bad we can't even talk about it. God's just got to wipe it off the face of the earth. I mean, certainly there was some assault happening here, right? But the visitors had even heard about how bad the story was before they ever showed up. What was so bad that God says, not even the plants can survive? And we're going to get to that, but I want to notice something in the story. I want to notice the difference between the insider and the outsider, because it shows up in the story a lot. So a couple of things for you to know about living in a city like Sodom at this time in human history. People like Lot came to the city from being what you would call a Bedouin, from being a farmer who grazed the land and who wandered from place to place, who took his family with him in tents, and they ate around fires at night, and they brought their herds wherever they could graze and find grasses to sustain their livestock. But many people did not live in cities. Cities like Sodom were pretty rare. But when you were in a city, life was very, very different inside the walls of that city. Because first and foremost, there is safety. No wild animals are just going to walk into your tent in the middle of the night. No robbers are just going to find their way to your family's campsite and hurt you or take things from you, right? There's safety in a city. There's also community in a city. This is a place where many families get together and they have this community where you get this connection with other people that you don't have when you're wandering the fields just with your own family. It's also a place of innovation. Creativity is sparked inside of cities. There's opportunity to be more than simply a farmer and make your way from day to day. Inside the walls of a city or a community like this, you have the opportunity to experience together what you can be for each other. There's something unique that happens inside of a city. And this story paints for us a picture of people outside of the city, right? And how they are treated when they come to the inside. And it's not a good treatment, right? It's a story of two visitors who come to the gates of a city. And a parallel between a family who welcomes them, who feeds them, who gives them a place to stay for the night, and then the rest of the city who are insiders, right? Who live inside of the city and say, we don't want their kind. This is a story to me, not just about two guys and what they experience, two angels and a family, right? It's a story about the responsibility a community has with outsiders. I mean, this is a story about what happens when a community responds to outsiders the way Sodom did. That this is such a big deal that the plants aren't even allowed to survive. Now, I'm not just like making that up and reading that into the story, because the Bible actually is very explicit about it later on. In fact, 24 books later in the Old Testament, in the book of Ezekiel, we get a reference back to this story. You don't even hear about it again. They've been wiped off the face of the earth. But 24 books later in Ezekiel, the prophet reminds the Israelite people about what was at the core of this conflict in Sodom. In Ezekiel 16, verse 49, now this was the sin of your sister Sodom. This was the problem with this city. She and her daughters were arrogant. They were overfed and they were unconcerned. They did not help the poor and the needy. Right? This, it seems like, is the primary problem that God had with this city, is that they forgot that they were supposed to be there for each other. They got rich. They had enough food. They became unconcerned about anyone else who was not part of the inside of their community, right? If the responsibility of a community is to look outside of their walls and to create space inside of their walls for those people, then Sodom had messed it up royally. That's the primary function of how God views a community. How do the insiders create space for the people on the outside? And this city forgot that hospitality, welcoming the stranger, taking care of each other was the primary responsibility of their community. And so God did something about it. And even in the New Testament, later on, generations later, Jesus and his disciples bring this whole story back up again. But if you're not following along with the whole story, you miss the point. So this is what happens in Luke 9. As the time approached for him to be taken up to heaven, Jesus resolutely set out for Jerusalem. And he sent messengers on ahead who went into a Samaritan village to get things ready for him. But the people there did not welcome him because he was headed for Jerusalem. Samaritans and Jews who head for Jerusalem don't get along. They're about as outsider-y kind of people as you can be to each other, right? When the disciples, James and John, saw this, they asked Jesus, "Lord, would you like for us to call down fire from heaven to destroy them?" Now, why on earth would they say that? Because they know. Jesus and his disciples are walking around outside. They are outsiders to this community. And Jesus sends some people ahead of them to say, "Hey, make some space for us so we can stay for the night on our way." And when they get rejected, these two disciples, James and John, go, "Oh, I know what happens when communities don't make space for outsiders. And can we do it? Jesus, I know, I got the answer right on this test. We'll do it." Jesus says no at that moment. But it seems to me that how communities function, the responsibilities communities have for helping people who are on the outside be part of what's happening on the inside, is a big deal to God. That neighborhoods who are overfed and are unconcerned are a big deal to God. And this is the story we start with today, because in so many ways, I feel like it takes all that we've talked about over the last 3 weeks and gives it to us in one story, right? If you weren't around the last 3 weeks, I'd encourage you to get online and listen to the podcast because it lays out this whole series in one story that so very clearly illustrates the responsibility a community has, a neighborhood has, a group of people have towards people who are not in that group. If we are going to be communities that look through the eyes of Jesus, and I would argue that we should, then our neighborhoods should worry about being overfed and unconcerned with what outsiders need. Our community should worry a great deal about how we help people on the outside become people who are on the inside. And I'll be honest, it can be really easy to sort of criticize a community or a neighborhood or a church or a group of people because it keeps it a little bit at an arm's distance, right? It's still too easy to say, "Well, that's not my job. That's the community's job." But communities are made up of individuals. And so we want to look at another story that moves this to make it a little more, if you're not uncomfortable yet, this is about to get worse for you. I just want to warn you. Because Jesus is about to tell a story that I think makes this far more personal and individual, and it forces us as people to wrestle with this truth. So here's the story that Jesus tells in Luke 15. It's a parable. We've been talking about Jesus' parables all month, and here's another one he tells us. Suppose a woman has 10 silver coins and loses one. Doesn't she light a lamp and sweep the house and search carefully until she finds it? And when she finds it, she calls her friends and her neighbors together and says, "Rejoice with me, I have found my lost coin." In the same way, I tell you, there is rejoicing in the presence of angels of God over one sinner who repents. So Jesus tells a story about a woman and a silver coin. And there was really only one kind of silver coin that Jesus would be talking about. Like in his culture, they had this one silver coin. It was called a drachma. In today's money, it's worth about $1. In first century money, it's probably worth about $20, right? It's not much. It's not a lot of money here. And there's a traditional way to read this story that I think matters about this parable, about what it means, right? And maybe you've heard it explained this way before, that you have a poor woman, and she only has 10 coins. So, you know, $200. That's her life savings. That's her whole, like, resource available to her. And she loses a tenth of it, right? Which is a lot. That's significant because it's her life savings. And so the point of the story traditionally is that she loses the coin, a tenth of her savings, and it's significant because she is poor. And so she searches her house to find it, turns it upside down, because it's such an important thing that matters to her because she is poor, which is not bad. I think it just misses a point that Jesus is also making in the story. Because when you dig deeper, there's a lot more going on in the story. So let me just take you through a few questions that I had when I was reading the story. First question I had is it significant that it's a woman? We're not even close to these questions yet, Kevin. Kevin just went like this, sorry. First question is, for me, is it significant that this was a woman and not a man? Because Jesus says a woman had 10 coins, right? Would it have mattered if it was a man? Is a tenth of your savings a tenth no matter who you are? Does it matter? Another question, does it matter that it's a silver coin? Frankly, if Jesus wanted to make his point a little harder, maybe a gold coin would have been better. Does it matter that it's silver? Third question, okay, so why does she have 10? Does that matter? Why not 5? Why not 3 coins? In fact, couldn't have Jesus have made his point better if she had 1 coin and she lost it, right? And another question, why was this such a big deal to her? She was frantic to find this, right? Jesus says she lights a lamp. This is in the middle of the night. She cannot wait until the morning. And then Jesus tells us that when she does find it, she brings all of her friends and her neighbors over in the middle of the night. Imagine if your neighbor knocked on your door at 2 a.m. and said, hey, I found my 20 bucks. We're gonna have a party. Come on over, right? I like a party as much as the next guy, but 20 bucks, I mean, doesn't seem like a big deal, right? And why does she say my coin? I found my lost coin. I don't say I found my dollar. I lost my $20 and now I found my, I say I found a dollar, right? I found some money, right? So let me give you some background to help us understand some of the answers to this story in a little bit different direction. Poor peasant women in the first century in Palestine, this place where Jesus was talking, had very unique engagement processes, right? When a woman got engaged, it went a particular way, right? When a young man met a young woman and he wanted to marry her, he gives her a gift. And that's still true today. Today, it's a ring, right? You get an engagement ring. But in the first century culture, it wasn't necessarily an engagement ring, which, by the way, the only reason it's an engagement ring is because the De Beers Corporation had a really good marketing campaign once. In fact, 3 months' salary, it actually used to be 2, and they said, we're not making enough money, so let's tell everybody it's 3. But that's a whole different thing. In the first century, they didn't do rings. They actually did necklaces that a woman wore on their head, like a head necklace, something that would fit around her head, and it was almost always made up of 10 silver coins that were tied together and hung on her head. To this day, they still do something very similar. They just use a lot more coins. But in Jesus' day, it was always silver coins, and it was always 10 of them. So now Jesus tells a story, and he says, there's a woman, and she has 10 silver coins. What do you think he's talking about? He's talking about her engagement necklace that she wears on her head. And then Jesus tells us that apparently she breaks one off or one falls off, and she searches the house and she lights a lamp for it, and she wastes no time because she says, this really matters to me. My coin was attached to this gift. I don't know if you've ever lost like your wedding ring, right? I was talking to one woman who said she lost it on a beach one day, right? And that's like the worst place to lose a ring, on a beach. She said she had all this panic that was sort of coming out of her. She frantically like, all right, we've got to comb the beach and find this thing and enlist everybody around me to help search. Like, it's a big deal. Maybe you've done that before, right? Where you've taken the sink apart to find it all the way in the back or underneath, even if it's gross. You see, there's something about our engagement rings that matter to us, not because of their money, right? It's not because the ring has some financial intrinsic value to it. That's not the real value of a wedding ring. You see, the ring in our culture sort of symbolizes all of the hopes and dreams held together in this relationship between a husband and a wife. Like, that's what's going on inside of this ring. And so it's significant more than the money it costs to pay for it. The beauty of the engagement ring is that it's personal, is that it's mine, right? Guys, do you remember the day that you proposed? right? I remember, like, I was pretty sure she was gonna say yes, but I was nervous. I was anxious because this is a moment of real deep connection between the two of us. This moment belongs to just us. Unless you're getting engaged today, where apparently you gotta call photographers and videographers and film the whole thing to put it on Instagram. But back in my day, it was just the two of us, right? But this ring isn't just a ring, it's my ring. And this woman's coin isn't valuable because of what it's worth. It's valuable because it's hers. It's valuable because of what it represents in a relationship with someone who belongs to her and to whom she belongs. So God rains fire from heaven to destroy a community because that community isn't living into a responsibility about outsiders. And it wasn't because they broke a rule. Right? It wasn't because they broke a law. It was because the people that God sends to these communities, those outsiders who want to be part of the inside, they're his. They're his. They matter to him in a way that a wedding ring matters to a bride and a groom. That's how God feels about these communities. That's how God feels about you and about me and about the insiders and the outsiders. That's how God views his relationship with his people. And for some of you today, that's the thing you need to hear. You need to hear that you are his, that you belong in his backyard, even when someone wants to keep you out of theirs. When someone wants to keep you out of their neighborhood, when someone wants to keep you out of their circle of friends or out of their family, you still belong to his. Whether you feel it or not, you are valuable. And for some of you, you've never been told that. You may have never felt that. You've been told that if you clean up your life, if you perform better or you make more money or you kick the habit, then you will be valuable, then you will matter. Some of you have had parents that have never told you you were valuable. They never told you that you were loved. You were made to believe that the only time you mattered is when you did something. So many of us for a long time have felt this lie that we have to earn belonging and value and love. But the message of the Bible, the message that Jesus tells and that in this story and in almost every story he tells is that you have worth right now. Wherever you come from, whatever you've done, whatever you are doing, you are valuable. Not because of what you have done, but because you are his. Because people matter to God, all of them. They are his. And so some of you need to take that away today and just sit with that and feel that and dwell on that because that matters. Some of you might say, yeah, I get that. I don't always feel it, but I kind of get that. And for some of us, we need to embrace that we're his. And some of us have already embraced that we're his. And if that's true, then we need to hear that we have a responsibility today. That we have a responsibility to light a lamp and to look for those who need help moving from the outside into the inside. We need to hear and feel and embrace that we have a responsibility for our neighbors, to seek them out. And we're not good at seeking out. We are much better at replacing. Amazon's got 2-day shipping and Black Friday sales. You know what? If it's $20, I can just replace it on my own. It'll be here in a couple days. I don't have to look at all. But there are people who cannot be replaced in our lives. There are people in our communities that cannot be replaced. When God shows us how communities and neighborhoods and it should function, the primary responsibility we carry is to look. It's to turn over every stone and to see who it is that God is pursuing because they are his. Communities have a responsibility to care for those who need it, to avoid being overfed and unconcerned with the poor and the needy and the people who are not like them. And we have the responsibility to search for those opportunities. Not because God thinks it's a good idea, but because those people are his. God has always and continues to invite us to work with him in shaping the world around us, to help outsiders become insiders. So let me end with some hard questions. Now we can put our hard questions up. Thanks, man. Some hard questions, right? A few days after we gather around a table with people who are already on the inside of our lives and stuffed our face, we need to ask, is my community overfed and unconcerned? Right? What role does my community play in helping outsiders become insiders? Think of your communities, your families, your neighborhoods, your township, your workplaces. Think about those places, right? And that's our communities, but what about ourselves, right? What is currently happening in my life? What can I do to communicate value to someone who doesn't feel valuable? That's a thing that I can answer. What can I do to communicate value to someone who believes that they don't have any? So I'll be honest, I had no idea how to end this sermon because those are just really hard questions personally for me. I think they're hard questions for us as a church. I think they're hard questions for my neighborhood, for Jamestown Township, for the communities and the people that I live. These are just hard questions. So I kind of just wanted to end right there. But after the story of the lost coin, Jesus tells another story that leads us to one more hard question that we'll just end with hard questions. And in this other story, he tells a story about a man with two sons. And when his audience, who are listening to the stories of the coin and the story of a man with two sons, they often think back in the scripture to where there was another story similar. And they might have gone back to a story of a man with two sons, the first man with two sons, Adam. And he had two sons, Cain and Abel. And in that story, Cain kills his brother Abel. And we read this exchange between God and Cain in Genesis 4, verse 9, where God asks a really hard question. The Lord said to Cain, "Where is your brother Abel?" "Where is he?" "I don't know," he replied. "Am I my brother's keeper?" The answer to this question, I think, is implied in the story of Genesis, and it's explained in the story of the lost coin, that the answer is absolutely yes. You are your brother's keeper. And I think Jesus still asks us this question today. Where's your brother? Where's your sister? Where's a person who doesn't feel valuable? And I tend to respond like his brother did. I think God cares about our brothers. I think God cares about our neighbors and that he cares about our communities as much as he cares for us. But we have a role to play. We have hard questions to answer. We have coins to find and rooms to light up. Because if God finds you so valuable that he'd light a lamp in the middle of the night and throw a party when he finds you, how much more does he invite us to do the same with others who are his? Will you pray with me? God, these are hard words. You tell hard stories and remind us of hard situations. God, I just pray today that you give us the patience to live in the hard spaces, that you give us the courage to ask ourselves and each other hard questions. God, I pray that you give us opportunity to take responsibility for the ways in which you've invited us to seek out people who are yours, to not place barriers between ourselves, to not just be good news for the people on the inside. God, I pray that you give us opportunities to be good news to people who are on the outside every single day. God, help us to view our communities and our families and our neighborhoods and our friends and every circle we find ourselves. Help us to view those circles through the eyes of Jesus, to hear your voice saying, "Where's your brother?" God, invite us into places that we get to practice being good news to others. And we pray all these things in Jesus' name. Amen.